Subject today is the issue of cloning in Jewish law. I'm afraid Rabbi Becher was not able to make it, so I'll be giving the class instead. This is heavily based on an article by two articles, really. One by Rabbi Michael Brody, who is a lecturer in law at Emory University School of Law and also rabbi in Atlanta, Georgia. And also on an article by Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz, who was the chief rabbi of England and also a member of the House of Lords, and of course one of the world's greatest experts on Jewish medical ethics. So that's basically the main sources for a lot of the class. Let me start with just a little brief introduction as to what actually cloning is from a purely physical, scientific perspective. What is cloning? Okay. So as we know, every human being, and basically every animal, is a product of a genetic mixture of that person's mother and father. What do each contribute? Well, basically, the egg from which a human being is formed has what's called mitochondrial DNA, which is the genetic structure of the outside of the egg, and also nucleic DNA, which is the structure inside the egg. The mitochondrial DNA comes totally from the mother. The father contributes nothing to the mitochondrial DNA. The truth is, mitochondrial DNA, we don't actually know what it does that well. Although there are diseases associated with the mitochondrial DNA, they will inevitably be from the mother, not from the father, because the father doesn't contribute that. However, the nucleic DNA, which is of course the main DNA being deoxyribonucleic acid, is the structure, is like the famous double helix structure, which has in it all the information and all the codes necessary for the production of whatever creature will grow from this egg. Okay. Just by the way, if you look at DNA as an information storage and retrieval system, it is absolutely incredible. Edmund Wilson makes a calculation that 1,000 million species of animals have lived on this planet. 1,000 million species. To now, I mean, there is approximately 1 million species of insects. So what volume of DNA would you need for all 1,000 million species? To produce the information, to contain the information of all 1,000 million species of animals on this planet, that have ever lived on this planet, how much of a volume of DNA would you need? The answer is a teaspoonful. One teaspoonful of DNA could contain all the information necessary for 1,000 million species. Now, that is just, I mean, it is extremely impressive. Just to make it a little less impressive, it doesn't detract much from it, but most of the DNA that we have is in common with most other species. Like the difference, I think, between the human being and the rattlesnake DNA is something like 15%. With some people I know a little less than that. But okay, on the whole, a lot of the DNA is shared. But anyway, the main part of the DNA that contributes to the nature of that human being is going to be what's called the nucleic DNA. And half of that is contributed by the mother and half by the father. In the normal process, the sperm fertilizes the egg. The egg, the DNA in the egg, will now develop. That's a combination of those DNAs will now develop into a human being. The egg will, of course, the cell will keep dividing, splitting, dividing, etc., etc., and the DNA will give information to all the various cells as to what to become, what part of the body they will become, etc., etc., etc. Now, the process of cloning is the following. You take an egg and basically burn out the nucleic DNA. Extract the nucleic DNA from the inside of the egg. And then what they do is they take DNA from another person. It could be a male or a female. It could be from the same woman that donated the egg. It could be from a different woman who did not donate the egg. It could be from a man. It's irrelevant, really, who it's from. And that DNA is implanted into the egg. So that means the DNA of this person that will develop from this egg is exactly identical to the DNA of the, we'll call it the clonor as opposed to the donor, right? But the cloner, the person who donates the DNA. So now there's a hook behind the door on the bottom. If she's trying to close it, anyway. No, she's got it. Okay. So now you have the person that will come from this egg will be genetically identical to the donor of the DNA, i.e. the clonor. So the clonee will have exactly the same DNA as the clonor. There could be many, many possibilities here. Then, of course, before I get there, you take the egg is then implanted in a woman, and it could be a third party. It doesn't have to be the woman who donated the egg. Egg donor technology is fairly advanced. People donate eggs, and their eggs are implanted. It could be the person who donated the DNA. It could be anyone. So any woman, this DNA, the egg, is implanted in the woman, and then it basically, the gestation period is pretty much normal pregnancy, and then the woman gives birth, and the child that this woman will give birth to is the clone of the person who gave the DNA, the nucleic DNA that was implanted into that egg. So this person could be a clone of a man or a woman. It basically doesn't make a difference. Now, there are people who are clones of other people that occur naturally. What is that? What two people have exactly the same genetics? Identical twins have the same DNA. So that's basically what the process of cloning is. Now, cloning has been successfully performed on a sheep, the very famous case in Scotland. There are those who claim it's done on human beings, but I think we can discount their claims. We're talking about a cult called the Raelians, who believe that their leader, Rael, a French journalist, was spoken to by a small green man in France, it could be a member of the French government, who knows, but in any case, a small green man in France spoke to him and told him that that life was planted on Earth by these aliens, and cloning, and of course they say the way for humans to achieve immortality is through cloning. We don't really have to take their claims seriously, it's interesting how exactly that gives you immortality. I mean, if you tell an identical twin that he's going to die but his brother will live on, don't worry. I'm not exactly sure how that makes him immortal, but okay, let's say no cushions on the Raelians. That's, you know, they're wacko anyway. Now, there are really a few questions that need to be discussed here. Question number one, is the cloning process permissible? Three possibilities. Either it's permissible, or it's prohibited, or it's obligatory. Those are the only three possibilities. In other words, what we have to look at it is in the sense of, why would it be obligatory at all? Well, maybe a person will say, we know that according to the Jewish law, there is a mitzvah of procreation, to have children. The mitzvah, by the way, only applies to the male. A woman is considered to be voluntary. She's a voluntary participant, and her fulfillment is voluntary. The male is obligated, not the female. This is derived from the biblical verses. What's the rationale behind that? There are many different possibilities. Some say because inasmuch as the process of birth is so painful, God did not want the woman to be if she doesn't want to go through that pain, she should not be looked at as someone who has done something wrong, who has committed a sin. So therefore, he didn't obligate her. Others say because the woman doesn't need to be obligated because she wants to have children. The man generally, right, wants to have appropriate pleasure and does not want the responsibility. So he needs to be obligated. The woman doesn't. There are many, many different possibilities, but basically, suffice it to say, there is an obligation to have children. What about a man who is not able to have children? He's not able to have children. Would it be a fulfillment of the mitzvah of procreation for him to clone himself, contribute the DNA to this egg, and now hopefully fulfill the mitzvah of procreation? So that's the way that maybe it would be obligatory. We'll discuss that. It could be that this is neutral, i.e. it's permitted. It's no obligation to do it because you don't fulfill the mitzvah of procreation through this. On the other hand, it also is possible that it may be prohibited. So that's the first question that we have to address. Is it prohibited, is it neutral, or is it obligatory? Second question is, what is the status of the clone in terms of his or her humanity, in terms of his or her Jewishness, And in terms of what are they looked at? How are they looked at? What is a clone how is a clone looked at according to Jewish law? And third, we would have to discuss also what's the familial status of the clone, the clonee. In other words, what is his status? Who is he related to? Who is his or her father? Who is his or her mother? It's possible for this child to have, for instance, one woman who donated the egg and the mitochondrial DNA, a second woman who the egg was implanted in who carried him to paturation, and a third woman who donated the DNA. So does he have three mothers? Right? Does his spouse have three mothers-in-law is the more important question for many people. But does he have three mothers? What's the... Right? It could be. Is it possible that he maybe has two mothers and one father? Right? I don't know. What's the relationship? Right? Is the person who donates the DNA, what is their relationship to this person? So that's another important question. What's the familial relationship? Which, of course, has many ramifications in Jewish law. In terms of the laws of incest, in terms of the laws of marriage, Jewishness, etc. Those are the basic issues that I would like to discuss. So let's start, first of all, the issue of the permissibility of cloning. There are many who have made the argument, and you find this, for example, this is a common argument in the Christian world, and this is, of course, as you'd understand, the argument which has been most popular in the American government, amongst conservatives, etc., because it's a Christian concept, but they feel that it's playing God. Cloning is playing God. How dare you? What right do you have? Etc., etc. You know, this is in the words Cardinal O'Connor, I have a quote from him here somewhere. Where's my Cardinal O'Connor quote? So Cardinal O'Connor says something to the effect that he says it is an abuse of parenthood. He looks at this as a demeaning the nature of parenthood. He looks at it as, here it is. He says, I offer three basic reasons for my belief that cloning is not permitted. This is, of course, the Catholic Archbishop of New York. He says, cloning is a drastic invasion of human parenthood. By design, a clone technically has no human parents. Hence, creating a clone violates the dignity of human procreation, the conjugal union of marriage, and the right to be conceived and born within and from marriage. A clone is a product made, not a person begotten. Very, very interesting, right? As he says, this is a little shocking. Cardinal O'Connor seems to say that he automatically has ruled for the Catholics I don't know if this is authoritative for the Catholics, but in any case, he seems to have ruled that a clone is not a human being. And he says, in addition, he says, in regards to the Scottish clone sheep, Dolly, it only came into being after the 300 attempts. He says, the first 299 fell apart. He says, so what about the destruction of the first 299, a human being, what about the destruction of these eggs? Is that not, he says, something wrong? He says also, cloning will never be a poor people's campaign. It could have become an entitlement requiring public subsidy, etc., etc. So, Cardinal O'Connor, and this is a general view in the Christian world, is that it's wrong to clone. What about Judaism? This is obviously what we're here to teach. Right? How do we look at it? First and foremost, our attitude is very, very different. We believe in the power of the human being. We believe that God wants us to actually conquer the world. God wants the human being to use their brains, their power, and their technology it's legitimate to change, to improve, and to modify the world. For example, in the very blessing and the command that God gave to Adam and Eve, where he said, "Pru urvu, fill the earth, milu et haaretz, fill the earth, v'chivshuha, and conquer the earth." Conquer the earth. In Judaism, we have no qualms about interference in the world through medicine. For instance, we know that in Christianity, there's a strong trend against excessive medical interference, because they feel that in some way it's just not right, it's not pious, right? Because God has struck someone, who are you to interfere? Judaism looks at it very differently. We quoted this yesterday, but the famous statement of Rabbi Yishmael in Bava Kamma, who says quoting from the book of Exodus, "V'rapoy yirapei, you shall heal him, you shall heal him." From here, the Torah has been given permission to the doctor to heal, and we know that we look at medical intervention as a mitzvah, an obligation, not as anything to feel guilty about. So that's number one. Secondly, the Maharal of Prague writes in Be'er Lagola, very interesting thing, let me quote to you. "The creativity of people is greater than that of nature. When God created in the 6 days of creation the laws of nature, the simple and the complex, and finished the world, there nevertheless remained additional power to create things anew. Just as humans have created new animal species through interspecies breeding, people bring to fruition things that are not found in nature. Nevertheless, since these activities occur through nature, is it as if it entered the world in order to be created? There are those who are shocked at the interbreeding of species. He says, certainly this is contrary to Torah law, which prohibits it. But he says, nonetheless, Adam did this. He says, the world was created with many species that are prohibited to be eaten. Interspecies breeding was not prohibited because it's immoral. Rather, the Jews, he says, should not combine the species together. It's the way of the Torah. It's a divine decree. But he says, as we already noted, the ways of the Torah and the permissible ways of the world are distinct. But he says, the mule had to be created. It was created by humans, not by God. The Maharal says a very interesting thing. He says human power is something positive. God doesn't mind if we do this. He's not threatened by us, right? It's not like his place in the universe is being threatened if we create a mule, right? The human being, God gave us that power to do it, and he sees no, unless there's something technically prohibited by the Torah, he sees no objection to that type of intervention. Lord Emanuel Jacobovitz, who is, of course, in an article in the Wall Street Journal, he once wrote, he says, "We can dismiss the common argument of playing God. Every medical intervention is such interference." He says, every time a doctor intervenes, every time a doctor cures a disease, right? The Salk vaccine, was that an intervention? Sure it was. He says, that's not a problem. He says, in the Jewish tradition, this is expressly sanctioned in the biblical words, "He shall cause him to be healed." The Talmud states from here we see that the physician is given permission to heal. Such interference is permitted for therapy, not for eugenics, for correcting nature, not for improving it. But he says, of course, to eliminate sickle cell anemia, to eliminate Tay-Sachs disease, to eliminate disease, that's what the human is supposed to do, to perfect the world. We're supposed to eliminate spiritual disease, we're supposed to eliminate physical disease. Even though cloning, in general, is not going to be done to eliminate a disease, but the fact is, he says, playing God as an argument against cloning, he says, is not something which we have to worry about. I should point out, this is of course Michael Brody mentions these two, I should point out that Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg does take issue. Rabbi Waldenberg, who's a very famous medical ethicist in Israel, who consultant rabbi at the Shari Tzedek Hospital for many years, Rabbi Waldenberg maintains that there is a prohibition. He says the permission for the physician to heal is only to cure pain, heal pain, and to cure sicknesses. He says not beyond that. He says improving someone's appearance, he says no. He says that's not our job. He says that's not healing. Not healing. Most authorities disagree with him. Rav Moshe Feinstein, as I said, Lord Jacobovitz and others disagree with him. But that's his opinion. But in any case, the vast majority of Jewish authorities maintain that in effect there is no prohibition against doing this, just in terms of playing God. And we find actually the Gemara, actually it's in Sanhedrin, says that the runners, King David had messengers who used to do running for him. They used to have to run, isn't the days before faxes and emails and stuff. How'd you send a message? You get a guy who's got a good runner and he runs. The messengers of King David, the Gemara says, they used to have an operation on their spleen and on their feet. On their spleen so they could run with great endurance, great distances without getting tired. They used to have an operation on their feet to toughen their feet so they could run over many surfaces and it wouldn't hurt their feet. Now, that's very interesting. So in other words, they did say, I don't know what the operations were, that's not really the main point. But here we see that the Gemara says that King David allowed and actually did operations on people, not to heal them. This was not to cure them, rather it was to improve their ability to run. You know, improving their ability to run doesn't seem to be therapy to me, right? And nevertheless, they're allowed to do that. So a Gemara, for instance, points out that that Jacob, when Jacob, our patriarch, was supposed to be rewarded by Laban for the sheep, right? What did Jacob do? He intervened in the breeding process of the sheep. According to many authorities, the Sfarno and the Ibn Ezra, right? I think Ebenezer was a physician, but the Sforno was. Sforno was a physician. They both point out that actually what he did was Jacob did this in order to influence the images in the sheep's mind, in order to influence the appearance of the offspring of the sheep. So now, of course, this is not cloning, but this, to a certain degree, may be looked at as some type of genetic engineering for the benefit of financial gain. It wasn't with human beings, it was with sheep, but nevertheless, seems to be permitted. So what we see is that as an argument against cloning, just to say, don't do it, it's the work of God, is not an argument. What about, so therefore, we would conclude, therefore, it's permitted, but what about the fact that it's the fact that you have to destroy the eggs, by the way? So most authorities hold, there's a great article by Rabbi Yitzhak Breidovitz, who's a professor of law at University of Maryland, also a great scholar, Talmud scholar. He writes, the destruction of a pre-embryonic egg, that is to say an egg that has not yet been fertilized, that has not actually started to grow, he says, is nothing. Absolutely nothing. It's water. It's like spilling water. He says there's no prohibition against destroying an egg if the egg has not yet begun to grow. He says basically it's not a human being, and it has no relation to a human being. So the other argument that Cardinal O'Connor uses, which is you have to kill all these eggs, is irrelevant because you'd be allowed to do that according to Jewish law. The argument that the clone will not be a human being, we'll have to see further on, but that's also, we disagree with that. What about it being obligatory? Would you fulfill the obligation of procreation with a clone? So that's unclear. An argument can be made in either way. For example, first of all, some say a simple a fortiori, kal v'chomer, how much more so? In the case of a regular father, how much of the DNA does he contribute to the child? Half. And through that, he fulfills the mitzvah of procreation. How much would the father contribute of the DNA to his clone? 100%. How much more so should he be fulfilling the mitzvah, right? It's not just like the kid looks a little, he doesn't like just resemble you, he's you, right? So therefore, right, the poor kid, but I mean, nevertheless, right, you look at that and you say, you could say, maybe make the argument that if in the case where you only contribute half the DNA, he's considered your child and you fulfill the mitzvah of procreation, how much more so when you contribute all the DNA? Maybe. Right, the argument against it is that, this is alluded to by Ramosha Feinstein in a different context, he says, is procreation, never, the Torah never obligates us to go beyond normal, natural lengths to go to do a mitzvah. So let's say a couple cannot have children. Are they obligated to go through reproductive therapy, egg implantation, sperm donation, etc.? Are they obligated to do this? The answer is the vast majority of halachic authorities say they're not obligated to do this. These things are, first of all, require a tremendous amount of emotional energy, tremendous drain. It's financially very expensive. It can be very painful. It can be very stressful. But it's not obligatory. Why is it not obligatory? Because the Torah says this is how you do the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to try to have children. If one does not have children, so you don't have children. But I mean, I'm not downplaying that. But what I'm just saying is the Torah doesn't obligate me to go beyond what is normal human practice. In other words, right, if I cannot fulfill the mitzvah with the body that God gave me, I don't have to go beyond that. Don't have to go beyond that. And consequently, there's no obligation to seek reproductive technology in order to have to fulfill the mitzvah of procreation. For the woman, certainly not, because for the woman, as we said anyway, it is voluntary. But even for the man, for whom it's obligatory, he wouldn't be obligated to do this. It would seem to imply, and some authorities say this, the only time you actually fulfill, and some say the only time you actually fulfill the mitzvah of procreation is in the classic way. That is to say, normal human sexual relations, that's how you fulfill the mitzvah. Anything beyond that is not it's a good thing. You want to have children, even if you cannot in the normal way, it's a wonderful thing. It's a great self-sacrifice that people do to do that, but it might not be considered the classic mitzvah of procreation, unless it's in the normal way. So therefore, it certainly wouldn't be obligatory. According to the vast majority of authorities, not obligatory. According to the majority, it doesn't appear to be prohibited. What would it be then? We would probably look at it as neutral. Neutral. Permitted, not obligatory, not prohibited. Okay, what about the human status of the clone? Remember that Cardinal O'Connor, as we quoted in his article, said that this is an abuse because this person's not human. Jewish law would say the definition of a human in Jewish law is someone who is born to a human mother. If a woman gives birth to someone, that person is human. That thing is human being. That's what a human being is. We define it in that way. In other words, there are human beings who have very limited abilities. There are human beings who are handicapped in terrible ways. There are human beings who are born who don't look very human. This doesn't make them inhuman. The human being is someone born of a human mother. We find, actually, just to give you a distant analogy, the Talmud discusses, what about an animal born to a cow? Cow gives birth, and the animal it gives birth to doesn't have cloven hooves. It's a mutant cow. It doesn't have cloven hooves. Is this calf kosher? Is the calf kosher? What would you say? Talmud says it's kosher. It's a kosher animal. It's born to a cow. It's a kosher animal. Right? In other words, the idea of the cloven hooves and the chewing the cud, that defines the species which is kosher. Is there any question that a mutated cow born to a cow is not a cow? Of course it's a cow. The fact that it doesn't have cloven hooves, even if it doesn't chew its cud, it's still kosher because it's a cow. Yeah. Goes by the mother. Goes by the mother. Right? So in other words, the
DNA is not kosher?
It's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. It's born to, first of all, it wouldn't, first of all, two separate species are not able to have children. That, by the way, is one of the definitions of a species, is two groups that cannot interbreed with each other. Right, so it's a very, very theoretical question. But the fact is, it's that born of the cow makes it a cow. Period. End of story. The definition is, in Jewish law, that if this being is born to a human mother, this being is human. Clearly. In addition, the Talmud discusses the idea, it also talks about someone who has a human appearance and acts and talks and walks like a human being is also a human being. So in other words, according to Jewish law, there's no question that the fact that someone has got the same DNA as someone else, why should they be any less human? For instance, would you say that identical twins, one's less human than the other? Well, because there's already one of you around. You're a spare part, buddy. Right? Are you allowed to kill an identical twin? Would anyone say you can kill an identical twin because there's already someone with the same DNA on the earth? Of course not. So why would you think that you'd be allowed to kill a clone? Because he's got the same DNA as the other guy, so he's a spare part? Of course not. Jewish law would look at the clonee as human 100%. Be prohibited to kill such a person. It would be obligated to look at such a person as you would any human being. Kavod habriot, he is a human, she is a human. No question about it. According to, it doesn't seem to be any dispute in that according to Jewish law. The only one who is not maybe human is someone, the Talmud talks about someone created a golem, right? Someone created using Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, but that's not the same case. Because someone who's created using Kabbalah is not someone born to a human mother. In fact, the Hebrew, you know, one of the Hebrew terms you find for a human is Yelud Isha. You ever heard that term? In rabbinic literature, a human is called a Yelud Isha. What does Yelud Isha mean?
Born
to a woman. Yelud Isha. So the clone is born in the normal way. The paturation is normal. What's not normal is the way the cell has been seeded, impregnated, whatever you would like to call it. So therefore, right.
Well, in this case, there is no thought. There is no combination of thought.
That's a good point. It's a good point. The Arizal does not say that that's what creates the soul. The Arizal says that has an impact on the soul. That's a very big difference. Listen carefully. The Arizal does not say that creates the soul. If the Arizal would say that the thoughts of the parents at the time of intimacy create the soul, then you would have a problem. How can the soul be created? Here there's no possibility. That's not what the Arizal says. Listen carefully again. Right? Right. The Arizal says it influences what this person will be like. So that doesn't mean that there is no soul without that. In other words, even with...
Souls are waiting there. There is a...
And the soul will come into...
There is a number of options of souls waiting in the shrine to come back to Gilgul.
And the soul comes into a human being. This person's a human being. The soul will come in.
Which soul is going to be chosen?
They only influence it. That's not the decisive factor. Do we know? That's not the decisive factor. Influence means that something has an impact. It doesn't mean it's decisive. It doesn't mean it's decisive. Right? I don't know if you've seen the Arizal inside, but that's not, the Arizal doesn't say that it's impossible without, there's no way the soul come down to earth without that. Why not? God can put a soul into a human being, born of a human mother, God can put a soul into a human being. I don't see that as an issue. So God will choose the soul. Why does it have to be the, I don't know why he hung up on that. God will choose the soul. Why should, if the parents don't choose the soul, God will choose the soul. Simple. Basically right. That's right. There are millions of people who have children on a regular basis without any thoughts of sanctity or anything like that, and they have a child. Jewish, non-Jewish, you name it. So it's a good point. So anyway, now, what about the Judaism or the, and the familial status of this human being? Is this person Jewish? So here we know, according to Jewish law, there is one definition of a Jew. How is a Jew born? One definition. Jewish mother gives birth, child's Jewish. However, very interesting, in terms of here, there could be that the child has two mothers. According to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he maintains that if the egg is donated by another woman, that other woman also has a relationship with this clone. So that means one woman donates an egg, the egg is then given DNA from whoever, right? That egg is now planted in a third woman, second woman who gives birth. The one who gives birth is certainly the mother. No, everyone agrees on that. Some authorities say this child might have two mothers, because the one who donates the egg is also considered a mother. So now, what happens if the one who donates the egg is not Jewish, and the one who gives birth is Jewish? What is the status of this child? Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says it's a case of doubt, and the child should have a conversion, lechumra, that is to say, should to be safe, on the safe side, should actually go through a conversion to Judaism. However, many authorities disagree, and they say that whoever gave birth, that's the sole definition of the mother. One of the proofs is a very interesting Gemara. The Gemara says that Rachel and Leah, two of the wives of Jacob, our patriarch, right, what do we know? Leah had already had how many boys? Four boys. So she was pregnant, and her sister Rachel was pregnant. She did not want her sister to have less than her fair share of the children of Jacob. So therefore she prayed that the fetus within her, if it was a boy, should go to Rachel. As it happened, Rachel's fetus was indeed a girl, and Leah's fetus was a boy. And what did God do? He switched the feti? It's plural of fetus, for heaven's sakes. All right, doesn't matter. He switched the kids, right? And Leah gave birth to Dinah, right, who was the daughter of Jacob. And that, of course, who, according to every source that I've ever seen, the mother of Dinah is always considered to be Leah. It's not Rachel. So, I don't know if you can bring a proof, because this is a Midrash, and it's very difficult to bring halachic evidence from Midrashim, but nevertheless, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, possible for the child to have two mothers. Who is the father? The child might not have a father. Is it possible for a child not to have a father in Jewish law? Yes. If a Jewish woman and a non-Jewish man have a child, who is the child's father according to Jewish law? According to Jewish law, he's not related to his father, because since his father's not Jewish and he is Jewish, they're not related. So therefore, here's a child's got a mother, no father. Does that make him not Jewish? No, he's 100% Jewish. So Jewishness is born to a Jewish mother, born in the Jewish womb, as the old song goes. Or is that born in the USA? I'm sorry, yes, it's born in the USA. But anyway, born to a Jewish mother is what makes the child Jewish 100%. Now, and again, as I said, according to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, it's a doubt if the egg was from a third-party woman. Yes?
When is the male DNA is used, is this child Cohen, Levi, or Israel?
Interesting question. Generally, we would say that that there has to be a physical father. That is to say, or rather not a physical father, but a father in the normal method to transfer the tribal relationship. Okay, so I'll tell you, that's actually a matter of dispute. I'll tell you, Rav Moshe Feinstein has an interesting response about this. The question he was addressed was, a woman, there was a sperm donation, and the sperm was donated by someone who is not her husband, which is not allowed, but let's say it happened, it got messed up, whatever, and the person who made the sperm which fertilized the egg, which she has, her egg, is from someone who she's not married to, and she's a married woman. So now, according to Jewish law, a child born from an adulterous or an incestuous relationship, that child is a mamzer. Okay? Don't use the term illegitimate, because that makes it confusing, because you see, illegitimacy in English means someone born out of wedlock. In Jewish law, if two people are not married to anyone have a child, that child's 100% kosher. No problem whatsoever. No problem whatsoever. Right? Mamzerut is when a child is born from an incestuous or adulterous relationship. So now the question was, is this child born from the artificial insemination from a donor who is not her husband, is he a mamzer? So many authorities say, yes, he is. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in a landmark ruling, says, no, he is not. He says a mamzer is a product of an adulterous or an incestuous relationship. If there was no adulterous or incestuous relationship, meaning a physical intimacy, then he says that child is, he says the genetics makes not an iota of difference in terms of the fatherhood of the child. And consequently, he ignores the genetics of it and says this child is a kosher Jew, not a mamzer. Very interesting. What are the ramifications for cloning? Ramifications for cloning are, it doesn't matter what the DNA of the father is, right? Because it doesn't create it doesn't create a mamzer, etc. But also, it might be implied that it doesn't also create the offspring in terms of the tribal relationship. Now, what about relations? What about familial status? What's the family status of the clone? Right? Who's his? Right? Let's say the person donated the DNA is a male. Is that male his father or his brother? Right? Or let's say the person donated the DNA, the woman who donated the DNA is the woman who gave birth. So she gives birth to someone. Is that her sister or her daughter? Why is it her sister? Because she's got the same... The only other person you could have the same DNA with is your identical twin, right? So maybe you say it's an identical twin, so it's your sister. Person gave birth to a sister. So it doesn't matter to be the same age, right? Same DNA, sister. However, Jewish law doesn't recognize same DNA as the definition of being of siblinghood. Is that such a word? Siblitis? No, I don't know. Anyway, but it doesn't recognize siblinghood as being defined by the DNA. How do you become... What's a sibling? What's the definition of a sibling? Two people who share the same parents. That's what a sibling is. And the Gemara has many cases of people who actually don't share the same parents but are related, like people who, let's say, were born to a non-Jewish father or mother, etc., different combinations of that, and then they converted afterwards. Are they siblings? They have the same parents? I mean, the whole complicated issues like that. But basically, the general definition accepted is a sibling is someone who has the same parents as you have. And therefore, this woman who gives birth to this child who is her own clone, she's not giving birth to her identical twin sister, she's indeed giving birth to her daughter with all the relevant halachic issues involved in terms of incest and in terms of familial relationships. Yeah.
Just going back to what you said, adulterous or incestuous relationship, would that also qualify with the DNA? Where does the DNA come from? A child, from a woman having DNA of her own child, an older child,
an older son, or an older, you know? Right. So this child's sibling, doesn't matter. Right, it doesn't... I don't think it would make a difference, no. Now, I think here we're getting into a little bit of a shaky ground, because I don't think it would be... I can see that rabbis might prohibit this because of the terrible confusion and psychological problems this would create. Because imagine, right, that you have a sibling who's your mother. I mean, it's like, you know, the type... I mean, families are bad, like, you know, today, dysfunctional enough as it is, you know. Right, so imagine you have a dysfunctional family, they all look exactly the same, they all are the same, I mean, it's like a horrible, right? So again, you know, you don't want to, I can understand that a rabbi might say, you know what, this is going to destroy the family structure to do it this way, and especially if you don't agree with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Those authorities who don't agree with Rav Moshe Feinstein and say that the genetics does have an impact on the mamzerut or familial status, they might say, yeah, there's serious problems here, because there may be considered to be incestuous or adulterous in some way. So therefore, we'd certainly say to stay away from that type of situation. Some claim that one of the problems with cloning is that people might clone themselves in order to have someone so they can get a blood donation or a bone marrow donation. There are those who object to that. First of all, Jewish law says, once Jewish law has decided that the clone is totally human, then that's not a danger. Why is it not a danger? Because if you decide that law decides this person's a human being, you can only do things with their consent. End of story. Right? It's not a problem. Some would say, yes, but how can you bring a person in the world in order to save someone else? The answer is, I don't think it's an issue. Why? People have children for many reasons. Is it wrong for a person to have a child because they want someone to take care of them in their old age? There are people who have that in mind. And there are people who have children to have a tax break. I don't know. Right? There are people, I mean, probably more expensive in the long run. Anyway, I have to work that out. So, but there are people who have children, right, for a variety of reasons. We're not going to prohibit people from having a child because their reasons, you know, go do a test. Every person that has a child, you have to do a test whether their intentions are pure. To create a being to whom I want to bestow loving kindness? I don't think that works that way. I don't think it's like that. Many people have different motivations. So I don't think we'd look at that as inherently some reason to prohibit. So I think that's pretty much a wrap-up. I was supposed to condense this class, which is why it's so short. But that's pretty much the idea. Okay, so that's it for today. Thank you very much.